Blog Talk Radio. This is the news in brief from the United Nations. The United Nations will continue to deliver desperately needed relief for the Sudanese people amid soaring needs, acute shortages of essentials, and fast-rising prices, the UN Humanitarian Affairs Office, OCHA, said on Tuesday. 10 days of intense fighting between rival military factions have had a devastating humanitarian impact. OCHA warned that people are lacking food, water, medicines, and fuel, power is limited, and the prices of essential items as well as transportation have skyrocketed. With more, here's OCHA spokesperson Jens Lerke.
The people of Sudan, already deeply affected by humanitarian needs, are staring into the abyss. Humanitarian operations are also affected. Yesterday we heard more reports of looting of humanitarian supplies and warehouses. We and our partners continue to deliver whenever and wherever feasible. And I want to emphasize also the heroic efforts of the Sudanese people themselves. Civil society networks now responding to the most urgent needs in their communities.
OCHA also said that a UN leadership team will remain in Sudan to oversee humanitarian operations from a hub in Port Sudan. Before the fighting erupted, some 15.8 million people, about a third of the Sudanese population, were already in need of aid. Both Russian and Ukrainian authorities should urgently investigate and condemn apparent orders to execute prisoners of war, POWs, the UN Rights Office, OHCHR, said on Tuesday. The development comes after audio recordings emerged on the 23rd of April on several Telegram channels in which people with apparent connections on both sides of the conflict in Ukraine appear to order the summary execution of prisoners of war or declare that there shall be no survivors on the battlefield, OHCHR said. One recording is alleged to be of a member of the Ukrainian Armed Forces and another from the head of the Wagner Group, whose mercenaries are fighting alongside the Russian military. The UN Rights Office warned that if the recordings are verified, the order to summarily execute some of those captured, including prisoners of war, followed by their killing or an attempt to do so, amounts to a war crime, as does the declaration that no quarter will be given. Access to vaccines and other malaria prevention measures could save the lives of tens of thousands of children each year, the World Health Organization, WHO, said on Tuesday, World Malaria Day. The UN Health Agency stressed the urgent need to prevent, diagnose, and treat malaria, particularly among marginalized populations, and called for stepping up new and existing interventions. The agency also announced that to date, nearly 1.5 million children in Ghana, Kenya, and Malawi have received their first dose of the RTSS malaria vaccine, which is the first recommended for use to prevent the disease in children. WHO's most recent figures point to nearly 250 million new cases of malaria in 2021, some 95% of them in Africa. Nearly 80% of all malaria deaths in Africa were among children under 5. Dominika Tomaszewska-Mortimer, UN News.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The bodies of at least 57 asylum seekers, including children, were found off the coast of western Libya Tuesday after two boats sank in the Mediterranean. The migrants were from Pakistan, Syria, Tunisia, and Egypt. Survivor Bassam Mahmoud, who is from Egypt, described the horrifying moments before one of the boats sank.
While the driver was turning the boat, some passengers started arguing with him. The weight was gathered at the front of the boat, not the back, so this made the boat sink. We started fighting for our lives, screaming and asking for help. It was an indescribable scene. I asked people from my country not to even think of trying this. Stay in your country.
Meanwhile, in Tunisia, the remains of at least 70 asylum seekers, mostly from Africa, have been recovered from the waters near the coastal city of Sfax. Local officials said morgues are nearly at capacity due to the rising number of migrant drownings as they attempt to reach Europe for safety. In Sudan, a fragile U.S.-brokered ceasefire between Sudan's warring military factions is in its second day as civilians on the ground report airstrikes are continuing, and the paramilitary rapid support forces say they've seized an oil refinery and power plant. Foreign countries continue to evacuate their citizens as fuel shortages, skyrocketing food prices, and a dearth of functioning health services are leading to a spiraling humanitarian crisis. The UN envoy to Sudan said neither side is willing to negotiate. This is UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres.
It is incumbent on Sudanese leaders to put the interests of their people front and center. This conflict will not and must not be resolved on the battlefield with the bodies of Sudan's people.
Harry Cory Belafonte, the pioneering activist, singer, and actor, has died at the age of 96. Harry Belafonte was born in Harlem to Jamaican immigrant parents. He's credited with popularizing Caribbean music in the United States with his chart-topping 1956 album Calypso, which included the hits Jump in the Line, Jamaica Farewell, and Deo. His musical success led to multiple acting offers. He went on to star in dozens of films and TV shows, but his driving force was activism. He leveraged his successful entertainment career to shine a spotlight on civil rights and to fund movements like the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s Southern Christian Leadership Conference. He participated in the 1963 March on Washington. Belafonte famously said, quote, "I was an activist who became an artist. I was not an artist who became an activist." After headlines, we'll spend the hour with Harry Belafonte in his own words. He died of congestive heart failure this week at the age of 96. Supreme Court Justice Neil Gorsuch sold a property he co-owned to the head of a major law firm that has since had 22 cases before the Supreme Court. The sale to Greenberg Traurig CEO Brian Duffy came just 9 days after the Trump-appointed Gorsuch was confirmed by the Senate in 2017. Previously, the property in rural Colorado had languished on the market for 2 years. Gorsuch reported the sale but left the box for the identity of the buyer on disclosure form blank. The news, first reported by Politico Tuesday, comes in the wake of explosive revelations about fellow conservative Justice Clarence Thomas and his ties to GOP billionaire mega-donor Harlan Crow, who lavished Thomas with luxury gifts for 2 decades and bought property from the Thomas family, which was never disclosed. Democrats are calling for investigations into both justices and for lawmakers to pass the Supreme Court ethics bill, which was reintroduced earlier this year. On Tuesday, Chief Justice John Roberts turned down a request from Judiciary Committee Chair Senator Dick Durbin to testify at an ethics hearing next week, offering instead a signed statement by the justices reaffirming a commitment to foundational ethics principles. Durbin deemed the statement inadequate and said, quote, "It's time for Congress to accept this responsibility to establish an enforceable code of ethics for the Supreme Court, the only agency of our government without it," he said. Graduate student teachers at the University of Michigan have been on strike for the past month, demanding fair wages, sexual harassment protections, and new provisions for campus safety, among other issues. In response to the strike, University of Michigan's president moved to withhold worker salaries and sent police officers to intimidate strikers, resulting in one graduate worker being attacked by an officer. This is Amir Fleischman of the Graduate Employees Organization.
Over the past 3 years, we've seen the gap between our salary and the cost of living triple. This is something that's being felt by workers all across the country, where corporate profits are at record highs, CEOs are getting humongous bonuses and even bigger salaries, while workers are being left to struggle and take scraps. Workers at the University of Michigan are saying enough is enough, and that's why we're on strike.
In Washington State, Democratic Governor Jay Inslee signed into law a trio of bills Tuesday in an effort to prevent gun violence. The legislation bans the new sale of dozens of firearms, including some semi-automatic rifles, imposes a 10-day waiting period after purchasing a gun, and will allow for certain lawsuits against gun makers and dealers. This is Governor Inslee.
These weapons of war, of assault weapons, have no reason other than mass murder. Their only purpose is to kill humans as rapidly as possible in large numbers. And I will say this, AR-15s should not be idolized. They should be prohibited, and that's what we're doing today.
The White House praised Washington for the move, but gun groups have already launched legal challenges to the measures, claiming a violation of the constitutional right to bear arms. Somali authorities say U.S.-backed forces killed at least 18 al-Shabaab militants over the weekend. 3 civilians are also reported to have been killed in the fighting. There are roughly 500 U.S. troops in Somalia. In Washington, D.C., Republican Congressmember Matt Gaetz has been pushing a war powers resolution to remove the troops. In Iran, 2 renowned actresses have been criminally charged for not wearing a hijab. Karyoun Rahi and Panteha Bahram could face prison time, accused of removing their headscarves in public and posting photos on social media. This comes as the Iranian government has intensified the enforcement of its strict dress code. Authorities are now planning to prosecute people who encourage women to remove their headscarves, while surveillance cameras have been installed in public places to catch anyone violating the hijab mandate.
This harsh and rude response will definitely either make things worse or will not lead anywhere.
The Texas Department of Agriculture issued a memo forcing its employees to wear clothing that's consistent with their so-called biological gender. The move is the latest attack on the rights of transgender people in Texas. Agriculture Commissioner Sid Miller is a Republican and loyal supporter of former President Trump. And in related news in Florida, hundreds of drag performers and supporters marched to the state capitol in Tallahassee Tuesday, protesting a new bill that bans children from attending, quote, adult live performances, unquote, which LGBTQ advocates say targets drag shows. This is one of the demonstrators.
Drag is not a crime. It's an art form, and it gives us a community that we didn't previously have, and that's what today is about. Today is about community. Today is about showing the Florida legislature that no matter what they do, no matter how hard they try, our community, LGBTQ, trans, drag, our community will always exist, and we will always continue to thrive.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report.
Good afternoon. I hope you're having a great day. Here in Northeast Kansas, it's a crispy 59 degrees Fahrenheit with, 62. It went up just in the last half hour. So it's warming up quite well. It's a hazy, very sunny day outside here. So hope you're enjoying your afternoon, whether you're at work or at play. Coming up in the second hour after Radio Eco Shock,
Daniel Ellsberg on Freedom of the Press.
I had possessed a top secret document about the Taiwan Straits crisis of 1958, in which we came very close to nuclear war. And I put that out just a year ago through the New York Times, who could have been charged just the same way Julian Assange was, to show how unconstitutional this application of the act actually is.
On the next broadcast of TUC Radio.
And now, Radio Eco Shock.
This is Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith.
The climate is broken. Are your savings helping the mad new expansion of fossil fuels? From RAND, Dr. April Merlot names big banks expanding oil, gas, and coal from the Arctic to the Amazon. Where does that lead? From London, broadcaster, author, and science journalist Gaia Vince breaks boundaries in her new book, Nomad Century, How to Survive the Climate Upheaval. I'm Alex Smith. Welcome to Radio Eco Shock. What are the coming decades about? Did you picture a nomad century? Award-winning science journalist, broadcaster, and author Gaia Vince does. In a book stuffed with science and investigation, Gaia says warming and climate disruption will force at least a billion humans to find new homes. They are already on the move. Is it futile to resist? Gaia Vince is published by the BBC, The Guardian, New Scientist, and more. She produces science documentaries for radio and television. Her book, Adventures in the Anthropocene, won the Royal Society Prize for Science Books. And now we have the new one, Nomad Century, How to Survive the Climate Upheaval. From the UK, Gaia Vince, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks, Alex. It's great to join you.
What brought you to this vision of vast numbers of humans on the move?
I've been following climate change for over a decade now, in fact, environmental change generally. And as part of my research, looking at this, I've traveled widely around the world, mainly the global south. And I've already seen with my own eyes quite a lot of climate migration, whether it's villages in the Andes that have had to leave and move to the cities, move to Lima or La Paz, because their villages have been experiencing drought year after year after year, and their livelihoods have gone in terms of their agricultural livelihoods. Glaciers that have previously fed their fields have melted and disappeared. And there are these enlarging slum housing, I guess, shanty towns built around cities from Dhaka in Bangladesh to Mumbai to Lima, you know, all across the world of people who have been forced to move. And I've also seen it in the rich world. You know, I'm half Australian, so I've seen my own family members and friends have to move because of bushfires across Australia or terrible floods that have made them homeless and then living in temporary housing or they've had to just completely relocate. And I've also got friends in the US that have had to move because of fire or flood. So it's not a problem that is limited only to poorer countries. It is happening everywhere. But what we're going to see is this vast wave across the tropics where in the coming decades, conditions will simply be too extreme for people. And that's where the majority of the migration is going to be coming from.
There has been a huge heat wave recently across Asia. Just last week, 11 people at a festival outside Mumbai, India, suffered heat strokes.
I mean, it's appalling, and schools have been closed. Buenos Aires has just come out of a heat wave. Europe, there have been forest fires on the border of France and Spain in March, you know, and this is the Northern Hemisphere where we don't expect spring conditions to have ended until, you know, at least May.
So in your research, what parts of the world are likely to become uninhabitable if the world warms to 3 degrees and beyond?
Well, so at the moment, if you look at just one metric, if you look at heat, at the moment, about 1% of the Earth's land surface is classed as uninhabitable due to heat. But by 2070, we expect some 20% of the Earth's land surface to be uninhabitable due to heat. And that is home currently to about a third of the world's population. So, you know, we're currently home to about 8 billion people. After mid-century, we will be looking at 9, perhaps as much as 10 billion. So we're looking at about 3 billion people living in places that are likely to be uninhabitable due to heat. But heat is just one of the problems, one of what I call the four horsemen of the Anthropocene. So it's heat, fire, flood and drought. These are the extreme conditions that affect. They really impact livability. They hurt property, infrastructure. They can ruin livelihoods, and they can be fatal for people. So we're seeing when we look at the models of the planet as we heat over the century, we're going to see this swayed around the tropics. So it goes as far south as Australia and Patagonia across the whole of the African continent and up in the US, up as near to the Great Lakes, in Europe, up certainly into Spain and southern France, and across the very populated places of Asia, the whole of most of India and China. And we're also, of course, coastlines are going to be affected by coastal erosion, much greater storm surges. We're going to see river deltas, the homes of some of the world's most populous, biggest cities, all affected. There is nowhere on Earth that is going to be unaffected by these conditions. You know, everyone is going to have some effects. But further north, the far north, those latitudes are going to be experiencing lesser impacts that are more adaptable. So we will all have to adapt to the new conditions. We need to start adapting now, and it will be much more possible in the far north.
And then in the future, you predict cities in the cooler global north will compete to attract migrants, and that runs against all the rhetoric we hear these days. Why would this happen?
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Where the narrative around migration is growing so toxic that a lot of nations are, you know, they're imposing all sorts of border restrictions to keep people out. But that's actually relatively recent. Until just very recent decades, most countries were more concerned with trying to keep people in and try and attract more people. You know, there were all sorts of schemes to get post-war, to get people from the former colonies and empire of European nations to come and help rebuild after the war. Australia had a system of called 10-pound poms to try and encourage people over. The United States was also trying to encourage people to come. And that's been the case throughout history, really, because economic productivity really depends on increasing that labour force. And as we move through the century, what we are seeing is already this demographic crisis really hitting certainly Europe, but also many other countries, from Japan to China to the United States, where people are simply not having enough babies to support an aging population. That puts huge strain on the economies of these nations. And the way to solve that labor problem is through immigration. So we are going to have to see a shift. And you can already see, you know, even the most populist governments who, with one hand, are turning back people, they're putting up walls, they're sending people to Rwanda or whatever the latest policy is. With the other hand, they're trying desperately to bring people in because there are labor shortages in everything from hospitality to healthcare to truck drivers to farm labor. I mean, really across the board, people are needed. And more flexible borders for movements of labor just increase the economy. I mean, some economists think that if we took away all borders completely, the global economy would at least double, if not treble, overnight.
But if you go before the public or a politician does saying we need open borders, you risk being shouted down. It seems impossible open borders will be welcomed by any developed country in the future. Who agrees with you?
I'm not necessarily calling for open borders, but I am calling for a completely different attitude and different policy or different way of managing our borders and migration patterns, because, you know, some nations are already well aware of that. If you look at Canada, Canada has plans to treble its population over the coming decades, you know, and it has a very different policy. But what we have had over recent decades has been this very pervasive, very strong anti-migrant narrative, this very nationalistic narrative across many nations, and it hasn't been countered. But it's perfectly possible to counter that and to change people's attitudes and to explain and extol the very many evidence-based ways that migration, that immigration actually improves economies, improves societies, and can really help with many of the huge challenges that we face over the coming decades. I mean, people are coming whether we like it or not. So it's much better to have policies that work with that reality and try and manage what's coming rather than pretending that and making announcements that we're going to, you know, get immigration numbers down or expel loads of people when it's just not going to happen. So, you know, that we've tried that. Many governments have tried that and it doesn't work. But when you say that people won't like immigration, greater immigration, well, you know, I would challenge that actually, because despite this very strong, pervasive anti-migrant narrative led by politicians and trumpeted by many of the of the media, we have got evidence through many surveys that the general population is not nearly as xenophobic as governments would like. I mean, if you take my country, Britain, we've just had, well, not just anymore, but we've had a very, very toxic Brexit debate driven largely on the back of this issue of immigration and this notion of, I guess, Britain for Britons. But despite that, if you look at any of the surveys, people are actually more positive about immigration than they were before. They are year on year becoming much more positive and much more pro all sorts of migrant and immigration questions when they're asked, for instance, should immigrants be treated second class when it comes to job allocation? The answer is no for pretty much everyone. Do you think we need to reduce immigration? The answer is no. Do you think we should increase immigration? The answer is yes. For the majority polled across the country. Now, you wouldn't know that if you looked at our actual official government policy, which is more and more draconian every month on immigration. But the actual population is far less xenophobic. And I think governments need to be a bit more aware of that and be a bit braver. There's a lot of timidity among leaders of all parties and even broaching the subject of immigration because people are so nervous about being unpopular. But the evidence shows that if you explain people movement and labor movement in a more positive way, you know, it doesn't have to be that way.
Yes, I remember in 2008, British scientist and inventor James Lovelock shocked many when he said Britain will become a life raft. Those were his words for climate refugees. He said the UK should start building schools and hospitals now to be ready for the influx. Gaia Vince, what do you think?
I didn't know that. I mean, it's very prescient. He was a very, very wise man. I met him a few times, and that's absolutely true. You know, Britain happens to be, certainly the north, the southeast is going to be and is already being very heavily affected by drought. We've already experienced some terrible heat waves and floods in other places. But the north, if you look at Scotland, for example, sea level rise will not be a problem because Scotland is still rebounding from the last ice age. After being pressed down so heavily by ice sheets, it's still rising, and it's rising faster than sea level is rising. It's actually going to be one of the beneficiaries of many of the climate impacts. It's going to have longer growing seasons. Heating bills won't be so much during the winter time. So there are places in the north which are much more able and will be much more livable into the coming decades. They will be the strategic centres, you know, as we go through this very challenging century of upheaval.
You point out humans are fleeing from the Holocene environment that we evolved into, willy-nilly into a hotter, more extreme Anthropocene age. Then comes a remarkable claim, quote, "We are all finding our feet in the Anthropocene, and no one has better claim than anyone else to the habitable 21st century landscapes," end quote. Do you mean I have no claim to my homeland of Canada?
Well, you know, what do you base that on? What do you base your claim on? I think we need to start genuinely rethinking this. You know, we are a mammal species. We're a tropical ape that has dispersed over a couple of hundred thousand years across, well, actually the dispersal was much more recent, across the entire planet. You know, we gain our rights to our square footage of land through accident of birth. And I think that when we collectively, as humanity, and it isn't entirely collectively, of course. It's the richer countries have had much more of a role than poorer countries. But when we collectively make parts of our planet uninhabitable, we must also collectively use the habitable bits to accommodate the rest of our species. You know, we work as a network. The only reason that you can be sedentary in your little space in Canada, or that I can be fairly sedentary in my few meters of London, is because everything that I need, everything I eat, all the resources, all the things, all my culture, everything is brought to me, and it's brought to me collectively from around the globe. You know, I have potatoes from Peru for lunch, beans from Syria. You know, everything I own has come through this network of humanity from across the globe, and by strangers who themselves are moving around. They are doing the migration, and the secondary migrations of our stuff have carried them all there. So I don't think that I can claim really any more right to a habitable land than anyone else. We need to stop this, what I think really is a sort of almost a narcissistic entitlement to a space and to a lifestyle and livelihood which, you know, we need to consider the rest of humanity, because we don't exist alone. We don't do anything alone. We are part of a human ecosystem, and we are part of a biosphere. We're part of a planetary ecosystem, and we rely on that. So cutting our own nose off to spite our face is foolish, of course, but also it's, you know, this is humanity is a collective pursuit, and we have a responsibility. We have a responsibility for people that we don't know, that are far away, but also for where they can live. for what they can drink. You know, I think the last COP that was held in November, there was a recognition that rich countries should pay poor countries for the losses and damages they've experienced and they are experiencing and will experience for climate change. Well, part of that loss and damage includes the very land that they live on and what they call home and how they make their food and their living. And, you know, if that disappears, well, we have a responsibility as a humanity, as a species, to help provide that for them elsewhere.
This is a climate emergency. Find out more on the blog, ecoshock.org. No sign up, just the latest info, free for all. Ecoshock.org.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith from the UK. Our guest is author and broadcaster Gaia Vince. We are talking about her book, Nomad Century, How to Survive the Climate Upheaval. You write about Spain and saying that from 2000 to 2009, they added 6 million immigrants, and yet we haven't seen much about anti-immigrant protests or politics in Spain. Why not?
I think there's been some really interesting experiments in different countries. You know, everybody is trying different ways to deal with this issue of human movements and how to accommodate them. And there are parts of Spain that have tried, you know, really hard new ways, new types of inclusivity. And I write in my book about Parla, which is a suburb, I suppose, of Madrid. It's outside Madrid, where they decided to take a new tactic with immigration, and they granted full citizenship. They really helped with inclusivity. They built housing that was decent and that was near to facilities with improved transport links, so people had ways and means. You know, if you help people to help themselves, if you give them the agency, if you give them the legal ability to work, and the agency to have citizenship and enough money that they can then form their own networks and they can become their own type of entrepreneur. These people repay the state far more than the initial input through taxes, through the education of their children, through all the services and social benefits and cultural benefits that new citizens bring. And what was found there is this, because these people had self-respect as citizens. They felt themselves to be Spanish, and the existing Spanish population regarded them and treated them as new Spanish people. So they were not sort of segregated into ghettos of migrants, which happens frequently in other cities where immigrants are sort of all housed in a block on the outskirts, and it's really degraded, and they're not allowed to work, and they're not, you know, they're given an absolutely tiny stipend, and it's very impoverishing. These people felt like they felt Spanish, they felt like citizens. And when the economic crisis hit, while other immigrant areas in France and Germany and other places experienced a lot of unrest among, you know, migrant populations who experienced incredible poverty at the time, the ones in Parla in Spain did not. They did not. They also experienced poverty, but, you know, they got through it without protest and without conflict with the, you know, there wasn't this rise of racism. There wasn't this rise of conflict at all within the society. It held together and they helped each other. And I think that is really a lesson. Social, you know, when we talk about immigration working and being managed, we need to talk about, first of all, the need for financial investment, you know, ensuring that people do have access to housing, to infrastructure, to health and education services and everything that that people need as citizens. And that's, you know, that's a problem when many governments are failing to provide that for their existing population. This is a policy failure. That's what's happening. So that initial financial investment needs to be made. But just as important is the social investment, that investment in true inclusivity that accepts that people coming are not lesser, they're not aliens, they are new citizens, they are part of the city of tomorrow. They are, their children and your children are the generation that makes up the future of your country. And I think that what we're often talking about, really, the elephant in the room is challenging racism, because many of the people coming are coming from tropical countries where they have more melanated skin than many of host populations in the northern hemisphere, far north especially. So we're talking about more darker skinned people moving into more homogeneously white skinned areas. And there is this very uncomfortable ethno-nationalism that's been building over recent years, which is this narrative that there is a pure, I don't know, Swede or a pure German or a pure whatever Czech person. And this is rubbish. Every single population genetic study shows that we are completely mixed up. We are from everywhere. We were until very recently migrants, and you can see that. We were all migrants. You can see that in our DNA. There isn't any pure ethnically pure race that really belongs to a place. That's just not true biologically. And we need to challenge that.
We're going to need international planning. Does the United Nations have a plan for this mass migration under climate change?
Well, I mean, there has been just in the last few months movements towards, there is this kind of compact on migration, which was an attempt to look at this in 2018, but it's not legally binding. Many countries either refused to sign or abstained. They either objected or abstained to signing this compact. So it's very much kind of an intention to start thinking about it and maybe do something at some point in the future. But, you know, this can't wait. We really do need something. We need, I think, a new UN agency, but with teeth to actually act, because we have a completely broken immigration system globally, and it is a global issue because people are moving not just within nations but across borders and across regions. And at the moment, much of this is very dangerous. It's not at all facilitated, and because of the danger, huge sums are being paid to all sorts of criminal gangs. People are dying needlessly, and they're also being held in, you know, refugee camps or in some sort of enclosure. I mean, they're basically prisons. They can't get on with their lives. They're not, you know, this is not a way to help host societies or countries of origin or the migrants themselves. Everybody loses in this game, and we could do so much better. You know, people move to where there's work. You know, that's where they're trying to move, unless they are fleeing instantly an extreme catastrophe, an evacuation scenario. Most people are migrating in search of a better life, in search of work, and they're migrating to where the work is. There is a need for this labor, and you know, we're not matching these at all. So it damages economies, it damages societies, and it damages families, people.
It seems absurd you and I are talking about displacement, possibly of billions of people due to human-made global heating, which we could have avoided. But here we are. Are you finding many people ready for this conversation?
Well, it's interesting. I've had a sort of mixed reaction. Some people don't want to talk about it. They don't want to talk or even think about the climate emergency that we're facing, this catastrophe where, we're talking about parts of the world, significant parts of the world, home to most of the world's population, being unlivable for months of the year within a few decades. I mean, this is really serious. You know, there are parts of the world that are already increasingly unlivable. Farmers are working at night with head torches because they can't go out during the day. That is not a life. But, you know, people are going to be fleeing. And so the responses have been kind of stick my fingers in my ears and cover my eyes, you know, or hostility to the idea of migration and to the idea of climate change. But that is, I have to say, as far as I'm aware, a very small minority view, actually. The majority of people are relieved someone is actually talking about this now, because this really is, it is a growing crisis in the making. You know, we know about climate change. We know that, you know, countries are on fire, they're flooded. I mean, the Miami
newspapers last week were leading with huge stories about the floods taking over the cities, and yet people are still investing there. We need to wake up to the reality.
Gaia Vince, what are you working on next?
Oh, well, this is for me a very important issue, looking at the ecological change that we're experiencing and sort of documenting it. So I'm working on a book about to try and explain our place in the biosphere for children. I'm trying to get my head around making people understand, or trying to help people understand what we're facing and understand myself as well, because it's conceptually difficult what we're going through. It is an enormous upheaval this century, and it's something that, you know, humans haven't really experienced before.
Where are the best places for listeners to keep up with your work?
Well, I'm on Twitter briefly until that becomes impossible. So I have a website, wanderinggaia.com, and on Twitter, I'm wanderinggaia.
Check out that site. From the UK, we've been speaking with author and broadcaster Gaia Vince about her book, Nomad Century, How to Survive the Climate Upheaval. You can find out more in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Gaia, thank you for sharing your time and your vision with our listeners.
It's my great pleasure, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Coming up, is your bank funding a wrecked climate for you and your family? Probably. April Merlot is next.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Net zero, blah, blah, blah. Actually, the world's biggest banks are funding more fossil fuels, not less. Projects to heat Earth beyond 2 degrees C are probably already on the drawing boards, funded and underway. Spurred on by the biggest profits ever seen on this planet, this crazy fossil fuel bonanza spreads from the deep seabed, through the Amazon jungle, right into the far Arctic. Are your savings helping to kill a livable climate? You need to know. All the sad and sorry facts, naming names, is found in a new report called Banking on Climate Chaos, Fossil Fuel Finance Report 2023. This comes from a consortium of nonprofit groups, the Watchers. Our guide is Dr. April Merlot, Director of Research for Rainforest Action Network. Merlot is the author of the 2015 book American Empire and the Cultural Politics of Sweetness. From Massachusetts, April Merlot, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Right. So in 2022, the big five oil and gas companies reported over $200 billion in profits, the most ever, and that's just the big five. Are we living in a new fossil fuel boom, and what is driving it?
It really does look like we're living in a new fossil fuel boom. Certainly last year, one of the things that was driving it was the conflict in the Ukraine. Russia's invasion of the Ukraine really drove energy prices to all-time highs, and I think whenever there are big profits to be had, big corporations, those oil and gas companies, are happy to rush towards those profits. So we saw lots of companies that had proposals, particularly for liquefied natural gas, but for some other of the dirty unconventional oil and gas sectors. Also, plans that they had kind of put on the shelves for a few years suddenly started dusting those off last year when they started to see prices going a lot higher, and really jumped on that moment to expand liquefied natural gas and other fossil fuels that we know we just can't, not only don't need, but really can't stand to extract and burn if we're going to stay within our climate goals.
Do you think the big banks and the fossil fuel companies know what happens if they go ahead with their expansion plans as far as the climate goes?
That's a hard question. We've got pretty good evidence that fossil fuel companies have known for a long time that burning fossil fuels increases concentrations of greenhouse gases, and that those greenhouse gases are heating up the planet, and that's likely to make it unlivable for all of us. And the fact that we know that they've known that for a while makes me not particularly trust them. So, for example, we sometimes hear from banks that they want to fund their clients to transition away from fossil fuels and to take the lead on a decarbonized economy. And I don't share that trust in fossil fuel companies to be able to lead us towards a decarbonized future, given that they've brought us to where we are right now. Banks, I think, have a little bit better chance of being taken seriously in their climate commitments. We have definitely seen some movement among banks, the biggest global banks in the last few years, in terms of beginning to articulate some climate commitments. Those climate commitments continue to be not ambitious enough to meet the challenges of the moment. And in many cases, we see loopholes that allow them to continue financing fossil fuel companies and raking in the profits that we know can come from those, particularly in times of high geopolitical conflict, like last year with the conflict in Ukraine.
This expansion, as your report makes clear, is going on all over the globe. And my studio is near Vancouver, Canada, so let's start here. We know the Alberta tar sands are among the most carbon-intensive fuels in the world, and you should read that as the most polluting. Who is paying to keep them going and even fund new projects there?
I mean, unequivocally, the top Canadian banks are the ones that are behind the development of the tar sands financing, the key companies that are doing the work there. So we see something like 88% of financing for tar sands companies is coming from those main Canadian banks, RBC, Scotiabank, TD. Those are the key actors financing the tar sands companies.
Yeah, but they're all in there. The Canadian Imperial Bank of Commerce, Scotiabank, Bank of Montreal. Basically, that means everyone with a bank account in Canada is funding tar sands climate wrecking, whether we know it or not. Shouldn't the banks at least disclose their toxic investments? Maybe we should have to sign off. Yes, I agree. I will pay for the tar sands and the climate wreckage.
Yeah, unequivocally, I think that's spot on. And I think that's the sort of absolute minimum ask, is for banks to be disclosing in a much more clear way exactly where their financing is going. And in addition to that, really setting much more ambitious kinds of targets for how they're going to decarbonize the portfolios that they've got. So we see RBC expanding their financing to major tar sands companies like Cenovus and Enbridge, right? Those two companies got $20.8 billion in financing in 2022 from the 60 banks covered in our report. But again, the lead banks on that are just across the board Canadian banks.
So a bank practically unknown outside America is the fastest growing investor in climate doom. I'm talking about PNC Financial Services Group, based in Pittsburgh. According to Wikipedia, PNC is on the list of the largest banks in the United States by assets and one of the largest banks by number of branches, deposits, and number of ATMs. So this is no Wall Street player or hedge fund. PNC is a consumer bank. It's using the money deposited by ordinary Americans to increase their fossil fuel financing by 77% from 2021 to 2022, according to your report. Some of our listeners may bank with PNC. What can they do about it?
This is a tricky question, partly because we don't see a whole lot of banks that are doing really, really well in terms of their climate commitments. So it's not exactly easy for me to say, just go shift your money to some other bank that's doing a lot better, because we don't actually see any super great examples other than a couple of banks like La Banque Postale in France. My advice is really to take seriously the mission that the banks have, which is to protect our money, to evaluate the risks into the future that might come up for our money, and to hold them accountable to that, right? To say climate change is actually the most significant risk that's facing us in our current moment. And banks have an obligation, right, as a foundational institution in our society, as an institution that we all trust with our savings, with our retirement. I think we have a right to expect them to be taking rigorous account of these kinds of risks and to make that known to them as customers, right, particularly for a bank like PNC that has such a strong consumer banking angle.
For me, the most frightening fossil fuel projects are appearing in the Arctic. Everybody knows the Arctic is warming four times faster than the rest of the planet. If that permafrost thaws and releases all the carbon stored there, we are literally toast. I thought there was some sort of unspoken agreement against exploiting the Arctic, but why new projects like the Willow in North Alaska, they're happening right now. Why is that?
Your guess is as good as mine why anybody thinks that's a good idea. I understand that in order to accomplish that, they even have to refreeze part of the permafrost because the drilling equipment needs to have the permafrost frozen, and the fossil fuels that are it's extracting, the burning of them is making that permafrost thaw. So it just defies all logic as far as I am concerned. One of the things, and I'm glad you brought it up, because we see loopholes in bank policies. So banks are able to, what really looks like greenwash through some of their policies. We saw a number of banks over the last few years issue Arctic exclusion policies, so saying that they wouldn't fund projects for oil and gas extraction in the Arctic. There are a couple loopholes around that. The first loophole is the one that we see with the Willow project, which is that those exclusion policies specify that they won't give project finance. Well, project finance is a very specific kind of financial transaction where the proceeds are designated for a particular project. It gets written into the balance sheet in a particular kind of way. The use of proceeds are really clearly articulated for that kind of finance. Unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on which perspective you've got, only 4% of the transactions that we've got in our data set are project finance. So that means if a bank has made a policy and said, we won't finance any projects in the Arctic, so only 4% of all of our deals are project finance and thus would be applicable to that. So instead, more typically, what we see is oil and gas companies and coal companies too, instead of asking for project finance, they borrow money either through a loan or they issue a bond, and the use of proceeds is designated as for general corporate purposes. So they don't specify a project that they're going to apply that to. They just say, we're going to use this for general corporate purposes. It's going to go where it needs to go to facilitate our ongoing business. So that's the case with Willow. ConocoPhillips received financing from several of the major banks. I think a syndicate of 12 banks lent money to ConocoPhillips in 2022. That financing was all with the use of proceeds designated as for general corporate purposes rather than project-specific finance. So that Arctic exclusion policies that some of those banks had didn't apply in that case. The other big loophole that we see with the Arctic is the geographic designation. So the few banks that do have policies will define the Arctic as the Arctic Circle. So they draw that perfect circular line. Well, that's not really environmentally or politically or economically accurate. If you look at the definition of the Arctic that has been articulated by the Arctic Council, which is the international body that governs the Arctic, the geographic designation is much broader. It's much more complex, so a little bit harder to navigate. And we see a significant number of assets, between 100 and 200 oil and gas extraction assets are located within the Arctic, outside of the Arctic Circle, but within that Arctic Council definition of the Arctic. So we see lots of loopholes like this in bank policies and just see this as a way that they're greenwashing, telling us on the one hand that they're addressing the climate crisis and on the other hand continuing to engage in business as usual with their fossil fuel clients.
Many of my listeners are concerned about the Amazon rainforest. We need to conserve that massive carbon sink, and it's a pool of species found nowhere else on the planet, and some people actually live there and they have rights. But there is more planet wrecking going on than just deforestation or fires. Tell us about the growing role of oil and gas extraction in the Amazon.
Really glad to be able to incorporate an assessment of bank financing for, in this case, 21 companies where we have evidence of direct involvement in oil and gas extraction in the Amazon biome in Brazil, Ecuador, Peru, and Colombia. So again, like with the Arctic, we use a more expansive, environmentally appropriate definition of the Amazon biome, so the Amazonian Geo-Referenced Socio-Environmental Information Network's definition of the Amazon biome. If you use that definition as opposed to the vague and really not kind of not precise definitions that the few banks that do have Amazon policies use, lots of extraction going on there. So we see Santander, a Spanish bank, is the top financier of Amazon oil and gas extraction. But some U.S. banks, JP Morgan Chase, Citi, Bank of America, also have exposure in that region. We see some really pretty reckless projects happening. GeoPark is a big driller in the Colombian Amazon, really has a bad track record of environmental and social issues and a long history of resistance and fight from indigenous folks on the ground. Frontera, Gran Tierra, a couple other companies that are drilling. And we just know that in places like Amazonia, where there's a high level of biodiversity, and that biodiversity is standing in the way of extracting oil and gas, we see forest destruction, and we see companies just plowing over the rights of indigenous peoples, human rights, just tremendous pollution and irreparable damage that happens as a result of this.
It's lawlessness in the jungle, and it's being funded by banks that we know and perhaps are invested in.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock, now broadcast by over 60 college and community radio stations in the United States, Canada, Britain, and Australia. I'm Alex Smith, saying, as we head into a crisis of energy, economy, and the environment, we need alternative voices more than ever. Please support your local nonprofit station.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest from the Rainforest Action Network is April Merlot, Director of Research. We're talking about the new Banking on Climate Chaos Fossil Fuel Finance Report 2023. April, as American coal miners go bankrupt and coal's share of electricity production falls in the U.S., we think of coal in the past tense. But what did your report find out about financing of coal in China and India?
Coal financing does seem to be declining. The cost of capital for coal developers is increasing, which I think is a good sign in some ways, because the more expensive it is to produce coal, the more likely folks are to stop producing it because it's reflecting the true cost to our society. We do see with coal power, the investments that continue to go in, or the financing that continues to go in to support coal power, are predominantly coming from Chinese banks. So we've got 13 Chinese banks in the scope of our report, and the vast majority of the financing to coal power is coming from those banks. Unfortunately, it's not just those banks. We do see a handful of other banks, including, as you said, the State Bank of India, but also still having some exposure are some U.S. banks, so JP Morgan Chase, Citi, and a couple of Japanese banks, including Mizuho, SMBC, MUFG. So those are the three big Japanese mega banks also still putting some money into coal power. Similarly, a handful of Canadian banks last year put some money into coal mining. Yeah, far too many banks still with exposure to coal mining, given the urgency of the coal phase out. I mean, you mentioned coal miners. I think I would just add in there that one of the real issues, I think, with the continued financing of coal mining is that really every dollar that goes towards financing coal mining is a dollar that's not going to creating those really good jobs that I hope are right on the horizon in the clean energy, in a more just, people-centered energy system that really has the potential to create a lot of jobs and help pivot in a much more just way for the workers that are impacted by a phase out of fossil fuels. So there's a real opportunity here, I think, to have a just transition where it's not like we're just kicking people out of jobs, but really thinking about what the new jobs are going to be, asking our financial institutions to shift their financing priorities so that they're enabling that new economy and those new jobs.
And your groups found bank financing to fossil fuel companies did not go up in 2022. Is that not good news, a sign that these banks get the message, they're living up to their green pledges?
So there's one bank where I think it's good news, and that's La Banque Postale, French bank that made a commitment in 2021 to stop financing fossil fuels. And as a result of that commitment, we saw zero financing from them in 2022. Our data set doesn't have any deals with fossil fuel companies for 2022. For the rest of the banks, including those whose financing for fossil fuels decreased in 2022, it's very difficult for me to see that as the beginning of a long-term trend, as much as it's probably, unfortunately, going to be an outlier. I don't see any evidence that it's a result of intentional policy decisions or changes in practices in those major banks. Instead, I think it's attributable to things that are going on out in the world. So higher prices for fossil fuels really drove up those profits, as you mentioned at the head of the show. Fossil fuel companies making really remarkable, outstanding levels of profit just didn't need to turn to banks for financing last year to the same degree that they have in the past. So that's certainly one factor, is fossil fuel companies not borrowing as much. You know, other things like interest rates being slightly higher, the dollar being strong against other currencies, those certainly are factors as well shaping the financing numbers. I just unfortunately don't think that bank policies are robust enough to explain the decline in financing. And I think the fossil fuel industry is on the brink of expanding yet again, and so we're likely to see an increase in 2023. And according to data that was compiled by our partner organization, Oil Change International, it looks like the fossil fuel industry is gearing up for a big expansion in terms of the number of barrels, billions of barrels of oil equivalent that come to a final investment decision in 2024. So we're expecting really a surge in fossil fuel financing in the next couple of years, unless something really changes in bank policies, unless government policy pushes banks to tighten up their lending and financing activities. But this is just really such a crucial moment, as I'm sure you and your listeners know, for speeding up the transition away from fossil fuels.
Yeah, this is one sad part in a way. It's almost like we're not fighting to stop fossil fuels and slash them. We have to cut fossil fuel emissions in half by 2030, according to the United Nations, or risk a dangerous climate. What we're fighting now is the mad expansion of fossil fuels to burn even more, to accelerate this whole awful process.
Yeah, I mean, it's really just unconscionable to be expanding at all. There's no way that we can stay below 1.5 degrees Celsius of warming, which, of course, is the point at which we know that the impacts are going to become exponentially more difficult and more expensive, honestly, to adapt to. Every day I look around and am somewhat surprised at how many people don't perceive the emergency that I think we're really in. And that IPCC report that came out last month, I think, tells us that there still is a window of opportunity. We still have a chance, but we need to move fast. And if we do that, if we're able to stop the expansion of fossil fuels, if we're able to begin not only to stop the expansion, but also phase down some of the existing assets, that we do still have a chance to stay within an amount of global heating that will keep the planet livable in the near future.
April Merlot, could you just list out the groups who are behind this Banking on Climate Chaos report?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. It's really quite a remarkable process. There are 7 co-authoring organizations. So it's a big report. Lots of work goes into making it. So Rainforest Action Network is the lead organization here. We also work really closely with the Indigenous Environmental Network, with Bank Track, which is an NGO in Europe, Oil Change International, Reclaim Finance, Sierra Club, and Ergovald.
Yes, we had the founder of Ergovald on Radio EcoShock. It's a great German environmental organization. What are the members of this coalition asking the world to do?
So we conclude the report with a recommendation specifically for banks. And those, I think based on our conversation, those recommendations aren't very difficult, really. So the first one is prohibit all finance for fossil fuel expansion immediately. Banks really need to just stop. They need to draw a really clear line, and that needs to apply to companies, not just projects. All those loopholes I was talking about earlier need to be cut out of those banking policies. We've seen a lot in the last couple of years of banks talking about their emissions reduction targets and their net zero targets. And I think on the one hand, that's very hopeful. On the other hand, we see many of those targets lacking ambition. And so we call on banks to adopt absolute financed emissions targets, so really rigorous targets that are going to lead to a reduction in the absolute emissions of their clients. We call on them to demand robust transition plans for all of their fossil fuel clients, including the existing ones, not just new ones. We call on them to protect the rights of indigenous peoples and human rights. And we call on them to really dramatically scale up their financing for a just and fair transition. So not too many demands, but a lot goes into making those realities. We know these are really complex institutions that do a lot of work to keep the global economy moving, but also have the potential to really support some pretty harmful projects on the ground. And really, I think as customers of those institutions, we all have the right and the obligation to be asking those institutions to live up to the promise of keeping our planet livable.
Yes, recently a few banks in the United States collapsed. The government made the depositors whole to avoid a cascade of bank failures. It was shaky. And it turns out the troubles came when people came and companies came and withdrew their money. And it sounds like we little people may have more power than we know, but as you've said, it's pretty hard to find a clean option. Maybe credit unions or maybe a few banks will offer themselves as real alternatives. We can hope.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think credit unions certainly are often a good option. And I do think there's a growing demand for banks that really have washed their hands of fossil fuels. And so hopefully that will be something that we can turn to. And also hopefully some of the big banks really will take seriously this obligation to be facilitating a rapid transition. On the bank failures, I would just say, you know, one of the big issues that was going on there is short-sightedness about evaluating some of the risks that were on the horizon. And I know I mentioned this before, but I really do see one of the jobs that banks need to do in order to be viable and in order to be fulfilling their mission in our society is to be evaluating risks. So the banking crisis in the United States has, to me, more than anything, just reiterated that fact that managing risks, including the climate risk, should be really top of the agenda for these financial institutions.
Well, now that the 2023 report is out, what else are you working on for RAND?
Well, you know, there's so much work building this data set that I haven't quite had as much time as I would like to dig in and find all the patterns that there are. It's a huge data set, so I'm looking forward to playing around in the data set to identify what other trends might be going on that we hadn't picked up on yet. And I'll probably write a couple of other reports over the next couple of months. I'm certainly interested in writing a report about the loopholes that I was talking to you about, trying to understand a little bit more clearly how those loopholes are enabling banks to continue business as usual. Also really interested to think about the relationship between bank policies and the financing they offer. So our report incorporates some really great analysis of bank policies that's done by our partners at Reclaim Finance and BankTrack. And so really looking forward to trying to figure out how to effectively assess the relationship between those bank policies and the actual financing banks are putting out.
Well, the report's easy to read, lots of good graphics. Where can our listeners download it?
Yeah, so we've got a beautiful website called bankingonclimatechaos.org, and you can explore the data. There's some data downloads. There's the full PDF of the report that you can download. It includes, in addition to the data and to the policy assessment, frontline stories, so stories from folks who are fighting really disastrous fossil fuel build-out around the world, including in liquefied natural gas in Africa and Asia and the United States, North America.
From the Rainforest Action Network, we've been speaking with Dr. April Merlot, Director of Research. Find more links and my notes to follow up in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Thank you for throwing light on this matter, April.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. The massive record-smashing heat wave across Southeast Asia is not getting the news it deserves. If this was happening in North America or Europe, you would be bathed in reporters talking about heat deaths, absolute record smash, plus damage to crops and the economy. But hey, it's India, Bangladesh, Laos, and Thailand. Do we really care? I am working on that story for you. We also missed another major climate signal. Greenland glaciologist Jason Box has been presenting on the Great Melt there last September. Normally, if that word has any meaning, September in Greenland is getting cold again. Nights in the capital of Nuuk average close to freezing. Higher up and further north, it is all frozen. But in September 2022, the unimaginable happened. The whole long coast of Greenland, so long you can barely imagine it, continued to melt into that month of September. A continuing series of storms and atmospheric rivers struck Greenland, bringing rain, strange September rains to Greenland, even in the highlands. High in the glaciers, temperatures were up to 8 degrees C above anything recorded over the last 25 years. Watery snow and ice is darker, reflecting less energy back to space. Greenland rivers were raging, pouring more fresh water into the world's ocean, adding to sea level rise. The ramifications are many and large. In the scale of planetary history, this was an event much larger than any human affairs. Did you know this happened? Most of us are over-informed about the lives of celebrities and scoundrels. We do not learn when our planet is sending out distress signals, even though it is we and our descendants who will live out that distress. Radio EcoShock, bringing you voices that matter. I'm Alex. Thank you for listening again this week and caring about our world.
You're on the air, Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell. Hi.
Yes, Mr. Bell, I'm going to give you an explanation of why the so-called global warming is occurring, instead of just letting you and all your liberal listeners attack our glorious oil companies, our great American oil companies.
Glorious oil companies?
Yes, they have done wonderful things for this country and have built us up into a wonderful powerhouse of economics, but don't try to get me off topic here. I'm going to tell you what is happening with global warming. It is because hell is becoming hotter, Mr. Bell, as more filthy souls are cast down into the center of the pit of hell.
Yes. Stoking the fires of hell, right?
The boiling fires, the boiling pits of sewage of hell are becoming hotter every day.
It's leaking out and causing global hellish warming.
That's correct.
PUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Daniel Ellsberg on Freedom of the Press, Julian Assange, and the Risk of Nuclear War. At the end of April 2023, film and radio producers, journalists, and nonprofit organizations, even city councils across the U.S., began celebrating Daniel Ellsberg's life and dedication to peace and freedom of speech and his personal courage. Of course, he's best known for the release of the Pentagon Papers, a top-secret study of the decision-making of the U.S. government in relation to the war in Vietnam, how long it had been planned for, and how, like the bombing of Iraq, lies were used to actually begin the war in Vietnam. In January 1973, Ellsberg was charged under the Espionage Act of 1917, carrying a maximum sentence of 115 years. Since the Espionage Act was first used against him, it was also levied against other so-called U.S. whistleblowers and against Julian Assange. As Australian national, he is not even under U.S. jurisdiction. Daniel Ellsberg has used his experience to defend Julian Assange and other whistleblowers, even up to current days, when it has become known that he received a cancer diagnosis that gives him only a few more months to live. Frank Barra spoke with Daniel Ellsberg on January 19, 2023. He's a French activist, author and film producer, and has edited books with Ilan Pappé, Noam Chomsky, Angela Davis, and Vijay Prashad. Here's Frank Barra.
Hello, Daniel. It's a pleasure to talk to you, and thanks for making the time actually to talk to me and answer a few questions. In 1971, with your colleague at the RAND Corporation, you released the Pentagon Papers. I was wondering if WikiLeaks or an organization such as WikiLeaks had existed at the time, could things have been different? Would things have been different, you think?
Yes, they could well have been different. I actually copied the papers in order to give them to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee in the first instance, which I did do in 69, almost 2 years before I gave them to the New York Times. And they repeatedly were ready to use them and then backed off two or three times, actually, encouraged me to think they would be about to come out. And I did think that was the best place for them to come out because they could hold hearings and swear in witnesses on oath and confront them with these documents and ask questions. So I thought that was the best channel for raising these issues about history. But they did back off, and I got very discouraged with them. I wasn't really confident the New York Times would ever come out with them because of the classified nature. And I might well have gone, if WikiLeaks had existed, I certainly would have considered giving them to WikiLeaks at that point when I got discouraged with the Senate ever holding hearings. And then when I did give them to the New York Times, Neil Sheehan, for reasons that remain somewhat mysterious, chose not to tell me that they were going ahead with them. He risked, in other words, my giving them to somebody else at that time. And in fact, I did deal with other senators and with a representative to get them out in Congress. I didn't think any other newspaper was likely to print them at length, which, of course, WikiLeaks would be perfect for doing if they had existed in digital form, if we could scan them at that point. At that point, these were all hard copy. So Xeroxing them was a very long process, and you ended up with 7,000 pages. Digitally, of course, that would be nothing. So yes, in terms of waiting for the Times, I would not have waited as long as I did. I didn't think they were coming out at all until the very day that they were going to publish them. So, and I would have said that since. People have asked me that since. What would I urge people to do now? And I still would say that a combination of Congress and the press, not just the press in general, but the New York Times, the Washington Post, one or two of the major national papers, would be probably get the most attention at first in terms of printing large amounts of material. And I would try those first. But if they delayed, as is often the case, I would then give them to WikiLeaks. Conceivably, you could start with WikiLeaks. People have had some bad luck with other channels being found out. So yes, the fact that it does still exist is worthy, I think, is a good thing. I work on a group called the Freedom of the Press Foundation, which I helped to found, and John Perry Harlow. And they actually were started in order to channel money to WikiLeaks at a time when thanks to government influence, nearly all the funding channels had been cut off. I think that's not true now, but we managed to get money to them. So I think that answers your question. The fact that it is there makes it available when the rest of the media back off.
Thanks, Daniel. You were prosecuted with the Espionage Act.
Yes, I was the first one to be prosecuted under that act. We don't have an official secrets act, as Britain does, because our war of independence from Britain resulted in a First Amendment, which they don't have, which forbids Congress to pass any law abridging freedom of speech or freedom of the press. And most countries don't have that with respect to the press, even now. So in theory, there shouldn't be any law which can limit this. The question is the Espionage Act, the way the Supreme Court looks at it, acceptable as an abridgment of free speech in the sense of being narrowly constructed and just for a purpose that Congress endorses, such as to a very limited degree libel in this country or obscenity or espionage for that matter? And the answer is no, it definitely is not a constitutionally acceptable substitute for an Official Secrets Act. And a British-type Official Secrets Act, which most countries have, would clearly be unconstitutional, criminalizing any and all release of any classified information that the government wants to keep from others, usually from the American public above all, or our allies, and to a small degree, from enemies. Very little of it actually requires protection from foreigners. A lot of it requires protection from political rivals in the U.S., other agencies, or Congress, which controls the budget. So a lot of that information, in other words, must be out, should be out, and is wrongfully held. My trial did not result in either a verdict or an opinion because governmental crimes were discovered just before it went to the jury that led to the dismissal of the trial and the charges against me. And really, there wasn't another case for another 10 years or so, and one after that, three in all, before President Obama. But then President Obama brought about 9 such cases, and Trump did the same in his first term. So there is an increasing use. The use against Julian Assange is the first time that they've used that act against, which is intended for spies, giving secret information secretly to a foreign power, especially an enemy in wartime. And Julian's case is the very first when they've used it against a journalist as opposed to a source like me, a former official who has possession of the material and shares it. So it's a blatant violation of the First Amendment, and really there wouldn't be much left in this broad, undefined area known as national security, which can cover almost anything the president chooses, in terms of restricting information. It would essentially be rescinded. Our war of independence would have failed in that respect. And really, the next step would be to use it against people who simply read the material or receive the material, which is in the Espionage Act. Actually, it's written in such a way that it can be used in non-espionage cases such as mine. They didn't charge me with being a spy. It's a non-espionage use. The wording of it can be used against anybody who receives the material. That can be in the media when the source gives it to them. And anybody, by the way, who holds it and possesses it and does not return it to a proper authority. Now, former President Trump is being investigated right now for that violation of the wording of the act, and President Biden is subject to it right now, and they found classified material in his possession. Now, in the case of President Trump, he resisted turning over that material when it was specifically demanded, and is therefore comes more clearly under the act. But just to show the ridiculous breadth of this act in a country that wants to be a democracy, or a republic without a monarch who decides everything in the way of information that can be put out, I reveal that I had possessed and had not given it to authorities a top secret document about the Taiwan Straits crisis of 1958, in which we came very close to nuclear war. And I put that out just a year ago through the New York Times, Charlie Savage on the New York Times, who could have been charged just the same way Julian Assange was. And for that matter, anyone at the Times or their readers could have been charged. And I made a point of that just recently to show that how unconstitutional this application of the act actually is. They didn't question me or do anything about that. So just to make the point a little stronger, I revealed in an interview with the BBC just a month or two ago that I had possessed all of the material that Chelsea Manning had given to Julian Assange before Assange gave it to the newspapers. He conveyed it to me as a backup in case his material was seized. And I didn't have to put it out because the newspapers did. But I am therefore as prosecutable by the standards of the Justice Department, with which I disagree. But by their standards, I am as subject to prosecution as any of the people they have, as Julian Assange themselves. And the reason I raised this was that if he's not to be the subject of selective prosecution, which he is actually, but if it isn't to be blatant, they can bring the prosecution against me along with him. And I will certainly not make a plea bargain with the Justice Department. They can't really threaten me as they have others with life imprisonment as they do the other people, which gets them to admit to a lesser charge, because life imprisonment doesn't mean the same for me as it did 50 years ago. And I risked that anyway at the time. So we'll try to take this to the Supreme Court and get them at last to rule on this, which they have never done.
Thanks, Daniel. So that'll be my last question. You've recently said, I am Julian Assange, and you've in a way explained this now, but I wanted to ask you, what does the persecution of Julian means to all of us, journalists,
oh, yes.
Citizens?
Even if he were an American citizen, this would be unconstitutional, and it is with respect to him also. That applies to the United States. But actually, to try to extradite an Australian who is in Britain in custody at this time and who gave his information to Le Monde, El País, the British Guardian as well, and Der Spiegel in Germany, means that our Justice Department feels justified in trying to extradite any journalist in the world, anywhere, in any newspaper, and conceivably any reader. Yes, we do get into a ridiculous area there. Anyone who holds the information, including holding a newspaper that has acknowledged that they're presenting classified information. And obviously, they're not going to do that to everyone. They can select who they want as a scapegoat for this charge anywhere in the world. So this puts a bullseye on the back of any journalist that has the courage, actually, to print information that the American government does not want told to its own citizens or to its allies or to anyone in the world. The information such as Chelsea Manning revealed through Le Monde, in this case, gotten it from Assange, about our knowledge of the corruption of Ben Ali in Tunisia, which everyone knew that Ben Ali was corrupt. They didn't know that the American government fully acknowledged that in their support of him. And that revelation implied that they could resist Ben Ali, as they did nonviolently, without being assured that the American government would oppose them. It would be embarrassing for the American government to support this man, which they themselves knew was both and tyrannical. So there was a revelation that didn't affect the U.S. particularly, but did in fact lead to a nonviolent overthrow of a tyrant in Tunisia. And that would certainly be subject to extradition on that point by the U.S. government if Julian Assange continues to be the effort continues to extradite him and to prosecute him. No journalist in the world is safe from that, whether they are protected by a First Amendment or not. They're not protected even in the U.S. anymore with this prosecution. Even if it ends, the very fact that it has occurred is, as they say, a cooling effect. That is a freezing communication on matters of great public importance. So there's already been a cost. But if public protest can lead to dropping this extradition, as President Biden should do yesterday, today, tomorrow, that will at least clear the way for honest investigative journalism.
Huge thanks, Daniel, for taking the time to do this.
That was a conversation between Daniel Ellsberg and Frank Barra. They met on Zoom on January 19, 2023. You can find the film on YouTube under the title Frank Barra Talks to 1971 Whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg on Freedom of the Press and Julian Assange. As part of the celebration of Daniel Ellsberg's life, the issue of nuclear war is looming large. Ellsberg's fame for disclosure of the Pentagon Papers overshadows another set of documents that focused on nuclear war and nuclear policy. He managed to copy the papers, but sadly, almost all the original documents were lost in a landslide. On May 22, 2021, during the Biden administration, the New York Times reported that Daniel Ellsberg had just released classified documents revealing the Pentagon in 1958 drew up plans to launch a nuclear attack on China amid tensions over the Taiwan Strait. According to the documents, U.S. military leaders supported a first-use nuclear strike, even though they believed China's ally, the then Soviet Union, would retaliate and millions of people would perish. Here's part of an interview that Paul Jay held on September 21st, 2022, that gives a contemporary cast to the problem. The title of the interview is Why is Biden Risking Nuclear War with China? Paul Jay is a journalist and filmmaker. He's the founder and host of TheAnalysis.News, a video and audio current affairs interview and commentary show. Paul Jay begins with a clip from 60 Minutes with Joe Biden.
Hi, welcome to TheAnalysis.News. I'm Paul Jay. Here's what Biden said on 60 Minutes.
What should Chinese President Xi know about your commitment to Taiwan?
We agree with what we signed on to a long time ago, and that there's a one-China policy, and Taiwan makes their own judgments about their independence. We are not moving, we're not encouraging their being independent. We're not, that's their decision.
But would U.S. forces defend the island?
Yes, if in fact there was an unprecedented attack.
To be clear, sir, U.S. forces, U.S. men and women, would defend Taiwan in the event of a Chinese invasion?
Yes.
Analysts in the U.S. and elsewhere, including Chinese, are saying this sounds like the end of strategic ambiguity over Taiwan. And it also seems that once again, the White House has tried to walk it back a little bit, claiming the One China policy is still in effect. But how there's a One China policy and a commitment to use American soldiers to defend Taiwan seems to at least escape me. Now joining me again is Daniel Ellsberg. Thanks very much for joining me.
One of the very few reasons I can think of for this very provocative behavior, undermining our supposed commitment to a one China policy, which Biden and everybody else have always announced and are still announcing. In other words, that Taiwan is a province of China, which the Chinese certainly regarded as being, not just Xi and all of his previous leaders. In fact, their nationalist feelings have focused for a long time, I understand, on the eventually being strong enough and taken seriously enough to regain control of Taiwan. In other words, that's a red line that we are rushing right toward to cross, not only by Biden and not only by these congressional bills, but the visits by Congress leaders treating Taiwan as a sovereign state, in effect, which is totally contradictory to the One China policy. Now, why would China particularly be concerned about that, aside from the fact that it's a nationalistic mantra that Taiwan is not an independent state of China, something that Taiwan agreed with almost unanimously until this century, till the last 20 years. Now, the best reason I can think of, one of the few effective reasons, is to sell more arms to Taiwan than we have yet done. The 1979 agreement with China, recognizing mainland China as the sole ruler of all China, including Taiwan, did by congressional, simultaneous congressional action, allow for us to sell defensive weapons to Taiwan under a certain ceiling. And we pretty much observed that. I think we can be sure that Raytheon and Lockheed and Grumman, both of Grumman, the others, would like to break through that, just as they are doing marvelously in Europe now and Ukraine directly. They would like to be able to sell weapons the same way they do to other NATO countries. But beyond that, also, before 1979, Taiwan was in effect a U.S. military protectorate since 1949, when the communists took power in the mainland. The Seventh Fleet was used to prevent any continuation of the Civil War, which had up to that point had led to the victory of the Chinese communist leadership. The Seventh Fleet was there to protect them with threat of nuclear weapons, as I revealed last year with some top secret documents that are still being kept top secret, on the fact that we were threatening and prepared to use nuclear weapons to defend Taiwan and possibly even the offshore islands, which are within sight, a few miles off the Chinese mainland. So that ended in 79. Up till that time, we had based this on Taiwan, which you can be sure the Navy and Air Force were very happy to have, and I'm sure would be glad to get back. We had, I'm virtually sure, I believe, nuclear weapons there. I visited there in 1960 for the Defense Department, and there were nuclear weapons there at that time. They would like to get those back. Well, it's very obvious. China has, in this case, not just nationalistic, but significant security reasons for not wanting that to happen. And strictly speaking, they don't even have to be in NATO to do that, nor would Ukraine have had to be in NATO for U.S. bases to be there. There could be, or other European powers, it could be bilateral arrangements then and now, which would allow for that. And obviously, Russia was reasonably concerned not to let that happen. And actually, I believe there was word that Biden was definitely prepared to negotiate on that point, on basing and weapons. But in any case, in Taiwan, the Chinese, I think it's a recipe. It's hard to understand that as other than a desire to bring about a war between China and the U.S., given the Chinese repeated vociferous position for the last 70 years that they will not reallow, they will not allow again foreign bases, U.S. bases, threatening them from Taiwan and preventing them from peaceful reunification in Taiwan. Whether they actually want, which is hard to believe, an actual war, they are certainly risking it. For whatever reasons, they are gambling here on such a war. And one thing that Biden is not, and I'm afraid not going to remove in terms of ambiguity, is whether he will use nuclear weapons, if necessary, to defend Taiwan. Is he going to say, to remove that ambiguity and to say, no first use, we will not initiate the stages of blowing up the world to defend Taiwan or anywhere else, or the Ukraine? By the way, he could easily afford to say that in Ukraine, no first use by the U.S., and to try to shame Russia from the threats that Putin is actually making now in imitation of the threats we made for so many years. But what's changed in Europe is that the Warsaw Pact countries, aside from Russia, moved over to NATO. And so the conventional conventional balances totally changed there, and there's no pretense of a need for us to threaten nuclear war in Ukraine. Putin is doing it for the other reason, and with no more justification than the U.S. had for doing it for the previous half century. To come back to Taiwan, there the situation is different. The Chinese, for 20 years, more than 20 years, since Clinton sent two carriers into the Taiwan Straits to intimidate them in, I think it was 1996, they have been building up that area, so the U.S. can't make threats like that and can't act with impunity in that area anymore. And in this case, I don't think Biden will be willing to give up the kind of threat that Putin is making if he were on the losing side in Ukraine. He won't give it up, and he should. It's outrageous for either party here, either superpower, to be using the threat of initiating nuclear war for any reason whatever. And it should not be. Whatever Taiwan's reasonable, realistic concerns, it should not be the case in this century that we are defending or protecting any other place by the threat to blow the world up.
That was part of an interview with Daniel Ellsberg held by Paul Jay on September 21st, 2022. You can find the full 43-minute film on YouTube under the title Why is Biden Risking Nuclear War with China? This rebroadcast is part of a celebration of the work and life of Daniel Ellsberg. He recently disclosed that he has pancreatic cancer and has only 3 to 6 months to live. He has remained active and productive and wrote that his editor knows that he works better under a deadline. And Ellsberg adds, quote, "It turns out that I also live better under a deadline." You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gelöden. Thank you for listening.